Today, in part 5 of our series, Stories to Live By, the topic is lost and found. So how do the parables from Luke 15 of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son affect our attitude toward people and our relationship with God? Here's Pastor Seth.
Today we're looking at one of the most popular parables that Jesus spoke. We usually think of it as the prodigal son. But there are really three parables that go together, one right after the other, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son, or really the lost two sons. When I think about the topic of lost, I'm an expert at lost. Now, we're going to look about the lost sheep. I've never lost a sheep, but I have lost two chihuahuas that were not mine. We were watching these two chihuahuas for a friend of ours who was going through a really tough time in her life. And one day, we had them out in the garage, and I forgot they were out there. And I opened the door, and man, they just took off. And of course, they went in opposite directions. Now, truth be known, full disclosure, I'm not a chihuahua guy. And when they left, part of me was sort of like, all right, yeah, okay, God has smiled down upon this guy. But then I thought, well, these two chihuahuas are like a son and a daughter to this woman, and she might kill me if I lost her chihuahua. So I went out looking for them, and sadly, I found them both, brought them back. I don't know about you, but, there are no detailed people at the Gatchell home. And we have lost virtually everything you can think of to lose. I guess the thing that we lose the most are car keys. Anybody relate to that? We're at car keys. Boy, not too many hands up. I may be on my... Okay, there are three of us, I think. Maybe by myself on this. Car keys, wallet, purse, cell phone. Okay. These are the things you lose the most. We lose the most at our house. But you know, losing something is not really the irritating part about this. It's the hunt. The hunt is what's irritating. Now, the thing that irritates me the most, and someday I hope to be mature enough to overcome this, is the hunt for the channel changer. Because you would think that the channel changer is really not going anywhere. We have a channel changer. It goes to that TV and only that TV. But you can't find the channel changer. Where is it? First place we look at our house is behind the sofa cushions. Not there. You look under the sofa cushions. Not there. You look under the sofa. It's not there. You look behind the sofa. It was not there. You look under the cushion in the chair. And then underneath the chair, if it's not there, you walk across the room to where the TV sits on this and open up one of the doors. And sometimes the channel chair or the channel changer has been moved there because company's coming over. As if that's where we always keep the channel changer. But for some reason, the Gatchell channel changer has legs and feet. I have discovered our channel changer that goes to the living room TV, and only the living room TV, in our bedroom, in each of the other two bedrooms. I have found our channel changer in our master bathroom and in the kids' bathroom. Think about that. What's going on there? Now, I have found our channel changer in the garage, on the front porch, and on the back porch. However, as sort of irritating as that is, the one that just was probably the worst of all time. Does anybody remember what this is? A cordless phone. Now, I want to show this to some of our kids and teenagers because they've probably never seen one of these. But somebody invented the cordless phone before the cell phone. And it was a great invention because, you know, before you're on the phone and you're trying to wash dishes, and how far can you get away with the cord, you know, and, you know, not too far. Now you can just go around the house, you know, anywhere and talk on the cordless phone. Well, the cordless phone at our house also, I think, you know, was whoever invented it with something really great. It's the button you push when you can't find the cordless phone. Because the cordless phone in the Gatchel home rarely gets put back in its docket. It can be anywhere. But you think, hey, can't find the cordless, all I got to do is go push the button. But because our cordless phone is rarely in the docket, most of the time when you push the thing, you got nothing because the battery was dead. Now, when the battery was working, you could hear this phone somewhere in the confines of our house. But because it only beeped three or four times, you'd push the button and go running as quickly as you could to some room where you thought it might, before it quit doing the beeping thing. If it did, you couldn't find it. Now, I have found this phone in every room in our house, bathrooms, garage, front porch, back porch. But one time, couldn't find the cordless phone in any of those places. I went outside, and I found this phone, cordless phone, outside in our backyard, 30 feet up in the air, in a tree. One of our children, who happens to be a son, I won't tell you his name, had the cordless phone up in a tree, and of course the battery was dead. Lost. We are good at being lost. C.S. Lewis says that there's one sin that every human being shares in common. He said it's the sin that when you see it in somebody else, even just a little bit of it, you just loathe that. It's the same sin that we are virtually blind to in our own life. Over the years, I've heard people confess just about every sin I can think of to God and to me. But I cannot, in all of my years of doing ministry, think of one time that a non-Christian told me that they were guilty of this particular sin. And I really hear it pretty rarely from Christians. It's the kind of sin that when somebody else displays this, you rarely see people respond with mercy towards this person. This particular sin is the kind of thing that makes somebody very unpopular when they do this. We are probably most unconscious of this sin in ourselves. And it is probably, I would think, one of the most diabolical sins, because so many sins, or maybe every sin, flourishes or begins out of this particular sin. It's the sin of pride. And the parables that Jesus tells that we're going to look at today are directed towards two different groups of people who are displaying this particular sin of pride and have no idea that they're doing it, virtually blind to. Luke 15:1 starts off that now the tax collectors and sinners, the first group of people here, tax collectors back there were considered liars and cheats and thieves and shysters. They just took whatever money they could from the people, and nobody really had any recourse as to the amount. There's no such thing as an audit. They just came in and told you what you owed. And sinners, and here it's in quotation marks, and here sinners are people that you would think of, maybe that you know, that are sort of those people. They do things that you wouldn't do. I would never do something like that. So these are the people, and it says they were all gathering around to hear Jesus. You have the picture? Jesus is teaching. Everybody's kind of sitting around. They're all talking, listening, having a good time. Then the Pharisees, the religious elite, and the teachers of the law, those that taught the Jewish Old Testament, this is the two groups of people that these parables are directed to, muttered or grumbled is the idea, under their breath to one another, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, they were not just grumbling about the tax collectors and sinners, but they were grumbling at Jesus. That's usually not a good idea. Something is amiss if you find yourself doing that. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. And the idea is something like this. Doesn't he know that if he welcomes them and sits with them and just kind of sits back and chats with them and has lunch, doesn't he know that he's probably condoning or communicating acceptance that what these folks are doing is good and it's okay, don't need to change? That's just sort of the thing that's going on in their mind. And with that, he begins to tell three parables. The first one is the lost sheep. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? Now, there have been several Christmases at least at our house where after all of the opening of presents is done and all of the papers everywhere and the tissue and the bags and everything, you know, we're picking up all that stuff and putting it in trash bags to take out to the recycle bin. And there have been times where, you know, when we're collecting up the presents and making little stacks and writing down who needs to write thank you notes, where we can't find the check. Anybody? This happened to anybody? Just the Gatchels. Okay. Well, there have been a couple of times where I've been out on the back porch opening trash bags and pulling out all kinds of Christmas wrapping and tissue paper and gift bags looking for one small piece of flat piece of paper like this that's a check. And the two times I can think of, they're both from Grandma. And so I finally found that. Now, there's something of what's going on here. A shepherd has 100 sheep and loses one of them. And then the question is, does he not leave the 99 in the open country, go after the lost sheep until he finds it? Now, I remember as a very young Christian looking at this parable and thinking, wow, if I lost one sheep, and I had 99 still here, would I go get that one? Sort of like risking the 99? Well, in that particular culture, shepherds rarely shepherded alone. Usually there was a whole bunch of them together, and they had all their flocks together. And so the idea of leaving the 99 to go get the one, leaving the 99 at risk, would not make any sense back then to the people that Jesus told this parable. And he asks it in such a way, it's a rhetorical question. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country, go after the lost sheep until he finds it? The idea is, of course he would. And so would you if you're a shepherd. And he's speaking this to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Of course he would go and find it. Verse 5. When he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulder and goes home. And the idea here is, just like the rhetorical question means, of course you would go look for the sheep. Here is a rhetorical statement that of course you would be happy when you found it. Now, when you lose something at home and you have to find something, aren't you happy when you finally find it? There's some kind of relief or joy. You tell somebody. Well, that's how the story continues. He calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." Now, there have been times in being a pastor of our church where I had a meeting coming up and I had a file with some important papers that in there, and I couldn't find the file. Couldn't find the document. Couldn't find the Xerox copies. You know, and maybe you have this at work where you have a presentation to do, and you've got the vice president up there, and, you know, some other people, and, you know, your neck is on the line, and you can't find your presentation. You can't find your little PowerPoint thing that you're supposed to do. Man, you are frantic. You are looking everywhere for that file or that little disc to get your presentation. But when you finally find it, how many people do you tell at work, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I lost it, and then I found it"? You know, you tell everybody you know. That's the story. Then Jesus says, "I tell you, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent." And really, there's sort of a tongue-in-cheek here, who do not think they need to repent. That's his audience. These guys look down on the tax collectors and sinners, but they don't see that much wrong with them of which to repent at all. Now, he goes from that right into the next parable, the lost coin. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, search carefully until she finds it? When Mindy and I were first married, we had one car, and stupidly, we had one set of keys. Anybody been here? Okay. Boy, there, you guys must think, how did the Gatchels live this long? Well, we need to take up a collection and put an administrative assistant in their house, you know. We had one set of car keys. Now, I remember over many, many years ago, think of the difference between if you lost the set of car keys or if your spouse lost the set of car keys. Now, I remember when I lost the set of car keys, and we're both on a hunt looking for the car keys. If I lost them, I'm thinking, oh, I'm a moron. How could I have been so stupid? Where did I put those things? I've got to learn to find one place and put them. I remember buying this key ring thing and putting it by the front door. That was the biggest waste of money I think I've ever did. We are just not key ring people. But I'm extending some amount of mercy to myself, even while saying I'm a moron. Now, how do I know I'm extending some amount of mercy? Because when my spouse was responsible for losing the car keys, my attitude used to be quite different. You catch my drift here? Lost. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins. She loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, search carefully until she finds it? So I imagine, if this was at our house, you've lost 10% of your cash at home. Maybe you got a $20 you can't find. Or maybe you had $100 in your wallet or $1,000 in your wallet. You've lost $100. Oh my gosh, what did I do with that? You think, okay, well, I went to Walmart. I went to CVS. I went to the Shell station. I got, oh, wait a minute. I remember seeing it at home. So now you know at least the money is at home. Now you go through the hunt at home until you find it. Now, then Jesus gives another rhetorical question. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And the rhetorical question is, well, of course she would do that, and so would you. Of course you would go and find this. Now, over the years, because we lose so many things at our house, with friends I have said, you know, I finally found it in the last place I looked. And I remember a friend of mine said, really? I said, what do you mean? He said, you mean it's like you're going to look, you found it at the 10th place you looked, but Seth, you kept looking until you got to the 14th place? Well, yeah, I found it at 10, but I just want to look some more. The last place. Well, of course, that's the last place you look. You found it. When she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together. Says, rejoice with me, I found my lost coin. So here the picture is. She runs outside. There's some of her buddies in the neighborhood that are doing gardening. And she says, hey, come over and guess what happened? And she tells them about finding the coin. They're, oh, that's so good. We're going to put this on Facebook. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. In other words, Jesus says, now, of course you would throw a party. You would go outside and you'd tell everybody and everybody would rejoice. But know this, while you're doing that, there's a party going on in heaven. The angels are all excited. They're all gathering around. They say, look at that. Look what happened down there over one sinner who repents. Now, what's he trying to say here? These two parables. He's saying there's something lost, and because it's valuable, we go searching for it. Because of the value of the lost item, it's important to find it. Now he comes to the parable we usually call the prodigal son, or the lost son. Actually, there's two lost sons in this story. He says, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Now, the word give there in the Greek, you're not going to see this in the English language, but in the Greek tense there, it has a sense of urgency to it that has the idea of demand. Give me my inheritance is the idea to his father. He does this face to face. Now, I remember when I was 34 years old having a conversation sort of like this with my dad. My dad had terminal cancer, and he said, I went down to see him, and he said, hey, I need to show you some papers, and he showed me a trust that he'd set up, a couple of different trusts, one for mom when he died, and then when she dies, it'd pass on to the three of us kids. And I remember looking at this and just kind of just sort of lost. Oh, gosh. I already know my dad's got terminal cancer, or he's probably going to die within a year, and mom, I don't know how long she'll live. But the idea of sort of getting money through the loss of my parents, there was something about that was just repulsive. It's not that you're ungrateful that they've saved up well and invested well, and they're going to bless their kids and our kids through that. But there's something repulsive about that. And so when you read this, I think, oh my gosh, does this kid know what he's doing? Does he have any idea how repulsive this must be to his father? Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, and got together there is sort of like he cashed out. He took the cash his father gave him, he took the property, sold it, put all that together, and set off for a distant country. And here he becomes independent man. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. My dad's not going to tell me what to do. My mom's not going to tell me what to do. Not even God's going to tell me what to do. I finally have everything I always thought it would take to make me happy. I can now go in any direction I want to with my life and do anything I want. Sky's the limit. And off he goes. Jesus says, and there he squandered his wealth in wild living. And the word squandered in the Greek language is the same Greek word that's used in the book of Acts. When the church, I think it's Acts 8:1, the church went through persecution, and it said it was scattered through all the regions around. North, south, east, and west. The same word. And the idea here is not only did he squander, he lost all of the money that he had, but he squandered it not just wildly, but widely, in all different kinds of ventures, looking for something to fill him up. Verse 14, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country. Now, you and I have probably never been a part of a famine, but I'm old enough, and a lot of you are old enough, to have gone through a recession, the last one beginning in late 2008. And our economy for the last 7.5 years is just kind of barely, just kind of bumping along. And you've heard stories, and some of you have gone through this, of layoffs, or of having your hours cut back to 30 hours a week or 25 hours a week, or having to take on some extra work because you're not working 40 hours a week anymore. What are you going to do about health insurance? Some of our folks have done. We have a new thing we call the underemployed, which we track. You don't hear about that much in the news unless you go to search out those numbers. The underemployed, which also includes those who have given up on finding work. Given up. Just can't do it. Can't find anything. You have college students, about 25% of whom, at the last statistic I heard, they can't find a job when they graduate. That is a staggering number. That's something of what happens to this fellow, except it's a whole lot worse. People are now trying to wonder where their next meal's coming from. A famine. And he began to be in need. Verse 15. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. Now, I guess if you have nothing, you'll take that job. But for a Jewish son to feed pigs, it's sort of like the bottom of the barrel. If I was this kid, I would hope nobody I knew I was doing this, because this was kind of an anathema in Jewish culture. He longed to fill his stomach, meaning this guy was hungry, hungry, hungry. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating. One of my first jobs when I was in high school is I worked at a local drugstore. And we used to call him the soda jerk. And that was the guy that made hamburgers and hot dogs. And I actually did some cooking. made milkshakes and ice cream floats and all that kind of stuff. And just kind of worked there by myself. did the dishes, cleaned the kitchen, kind of the whole deal, one-man operation for a few hours every day after school. And one of the things we had is a five-gallon bucket back in the back behind the door. And whenever I was cleaning off the plates from the, what the people ate, I would take a spatula and dump the food into this five-gallon bucket. And we had a guy that worked there at the drugstore, and he would take that five-gallon bucket home to feed his pigs. Now, when Jesus tells a story about how he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, I'm thinking, I don't believe I was ever that hungry. Well, that made sense to me. I would look in that awful bucket of all kinds of food that's been there for days and think, hey, I haven't eaten in a while. Somebody hand me a spoon. I longed to eat for something in that bucket. But no one gave him anything. Now, the kid not only runs out of money, he runs out of friends. And he finally hits rock bottom. When I think about this story, I think about the insanity of sin. This guy thought that when he took off, that he knew exactly what to do. He had all the resources at his hand to make his life complete, to make it work like he wanted to. And the very thing he pursued with all the resources he thought were available is the exact thing that brought him to his worst nightmare. He thought he'd be full and satisfied. He ended up being as empty and alone as he could be. He hits bottom, verse 18. He says, I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. Now, in that particular Jewish culture, if you had been a son and had treated your dad and probably both parents with such amazing disrespect and contempt and demand, it was not uncommon for Jewish parents to disown you. And if they asked, if somebody asked, well, how's Jimmy doing? They would say, here's the language, he's dead to us. Doesn't exist. Jimmy who? Idea. Now, I suspect that when this kid hits bottom, when he says, I guess I'm going to go home, maybe my dad will give me a job. This is the context in which he's thinking. Getting a job from his father is about the highest he can think is going to happen. If his dad is gracious in any way, this could happen. But what he most imagines is something like this. He's going to go home, and he's going to meet his father, and there's going to be what we call the cold shoulder, or the eyes that never really catch with each other, or sort of the roll of the eyes by the father, or kind of like, get ready to hear the lecture, I told you so. But the idea is something like this. The days that I remembered growing up of pop and son are gone. I've obliterated that. And about the best I can do, the best I can hope for, is that maybe my dad will let me come home. And he'll say, you can work the fields. I'll write you a check. That's what he thinks. So he got up, went to his father, on his way back from a long journey. But while he was still a long way off, and here the scene shifts from the big city and wild living, the pigsty, he's making his way back along a long countryside, the scene shifts to the front porch of the father's house. And here it says, while a long way off, his father saw him, and the imagery is something of the old man is out on that front porch, and he's scanning the horizon. He's hoping he'll see his son. There's something in his heart that yearns and aches for his son still, in spite of the awful idiot the kid had been, and was filled with compassion for him. And the Greek word here means pity, but it's kind of an unfortunate translation for us because in our current English culture, pity is sort of looked at in a derogatory way. somebody does something bad and you try to come up next to them and they say, don't pity me, like it's something bad. But the idea of pity, before it turns so derogatory in our current usage, the idea of pity was the guy's heart went out to him. His heart went out to him. His heart went out to him. Something of compassion and tenderness and a softness of heart is the idea. I can imagine he could see something in his son as he's even at a distance of a broken and bloodied, kind of bleeding, his hit bottom sort of attitude. He ran to his son. Now, old men in that culture didn't do that. And threw his arms around him and kissed him. Now, try to think about this in the Jewish culture. I remember working at the drugstore with my slop bucket. Now, I wasn't in a pigsty. I wasn't up knee deep, walking to the pigs, and feeding them and, all that stuff. But I can tell you, that bucket, wow. I mean, it had, pretty strong aroma to it. Just if it had been there just a couple of days. Now, this kid had worked in the pigsty, and his clothes were covered with stuff that you would have in a pigsty. But the aroma of that . You ever get around somebody who hadn't had a bath in a while? Maybe a homeless guy? Hey. And especially to Jewish men. And he says, he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He goes into his mea culpa. But at this point, instead of finishing the mea culpa, the father jumps in as if that's all he needs to hear and stops him. And here at the story, it's almost like Jesus hits the pause button. And we really don't know what happens between that moment out in the country as they're walking back to the home until they get back to the home. And then Jesus picks up the story. The father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe, put it on him. Well, the best robe is a picture of family. You're a family member again. The idea of him being a hired servant or being dead? No. That nonsense. Family. Put it on him. Put a ring on his finger. And the idea is the signet ring of authority in the family. And sandals on his feet. That may not be a big thing to you and I, but in that day, servants were almost always barefoot. Again, it's another picture of privilege, family privilege. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. Now, what Jesus is putting in front of these Pharisees and teachers of the law is this is what God is like. When you criticize me for spending time with lost people, tax collectors and sinners, you're really criticizing God. Now, this is called justification, and the Pharisees had no idea what justification was. Justification, well, those big seminary terms, theology terms, but in the simplest way I can think of, justification means just as if I'd never sinned. Just as if I'd never sinned. And that God, he justifies us, but it's not because we've suddenly turned our life around or done some great religious thing or spiritual thing. Justification is he declares us righteous, and then he takes our sin and he puts it somewhere else. And from that moment on, he looks at you without all of that sin and baggage you carried in. It's something like this. Imagine that you're the son and you're coming back from the far country. You've got your speech that you've worked out. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. And you're making your long trek back home. And you're carrying this awful sin with you. I hope you understand. I hope God understands. And you see the Father coming, running your way. And you're thinking, wait till he sees this. You get all the way over here and you say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. Now, what the picture Jesus paints here in the story is, he says, hold on to that thought. And the Father takes the sin and he says, I've got somebody else that's going to carry this from here on out. He said, my son is going to carry that on the cross. I'm going to take your sin and I'm putting it on his shoulders. And from now on, that's where it's going to stay. Really? But, no. Oh. Well, but, really? Oh. But, we're heading this way. We're heading to the party. From that moment on, that's how the Father sees you. And every time you and I want to go, oh, but what if... It's already taken care of. Somebody else bore that. The son of mine was dead, is alive again. He's lost and he's found. No longer lost, no longer dead. Alive and found. Now, the second son comes in. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of his servants and asked him what was going on. This brother has come, he replied. Father has killed the fattened calf because he is safe and sound. Now, the older brother is like the Pharisees and teachers of the law. And I can imagine that what those guys are thinking is if they're the older brother, something like, you are having a party for that idiot? After he lost everything you gave him? Everything you'd worked so long, all your life for? Squandered the whole thing? And you're giving it to him? And why are you throwing him a party? What's going on with that? The older brother became angry and he refused to go in to the house. So he's out on the front porch, he's stewing and pouting. Now, what should have happened is he should have been a co-host. Standing with his father, standing next to his brother, helping all the village people who were there to enjoy the family reunited. He didn't do that. He's outside. And being outside at that culture is sort of like if you're throwing a big Christmas party for family and friends and people at work, and you've got all these people in your living room, it's sort of like your teenager coming in and throwing a hissy fit, yelling, screaming at you because you wouldn't let him borrow the car. Bad timing, bad place. That's kind of what this is like going on when he's out on the front porch. Father goes outside, or he says, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, not my brother, I don't know the guy, that guy's a moron, has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Now, you read this and you sort of think, these are not just sort of extemporaneous lists of things that he's coming up with. It's sort of like he's engraved this list, this bullet point list, for a long time, and they just come pouring out like water over Niagara Falls. My son, the father said, you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad. And the idea here is from God's point of view, what else would you expect me to do? How could I do anything other than celebrate when a sinner repents and comes to me through the blood of my son? We had to celebrate. My character is such that I cannot do anything other than that. Because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Now, in one way, this is kind of a strange parable because it's sort of like, and some of you are old enough to remember the series Dallas. Yeah. After season 3, remember how season 3 ended? Who shot JR? Who shot JR? And man, you know, things didn't go viral back then, but that, you know, in all the magazines, you know, who shot JR? You know, and that lasted all through the summer. Season 4 started. Everybody's watching Dallas. Who shot JR? And they didn't reveal who that was until episode 4. Or maybe you've been to a movie. You go to a good movie. At the end of that, you say, how's the movie? Oh, it had a great ending. But some of the movies you go to and you see, oh man, what a stupid ending. Or they left us hanging. There's going to be a sequel. You walk in, why did I even bother to come to this thing? Now, this parable is kind of like that. It sort of leaves you hanging. Jesus is telling this parable. There's no conclusion as he's face to face with these Pharisees. When I think about this particular thing, I think about several things. I think about, in some ways, sometimes we're lost, like I was in college, off in a far country, squandering everything I had, coming to the end of myself. And there, the invitation from God is, come home. Come home. You're going to find this a lot better place with me than you will out there. But sometimes we're lost like the older brother. And the invitation there is, come in the house. Come in the house. You're missing out on the most important part of life. The value of lost people and finding life. Let's pray together. Father, it's so easy to be both of these sons. Each of us have our own version of what it's lost like to be the prodigal son, off in a far country, trying to make life work apart from you. A lot of us have hit bottom and found the wonder of the cross, and that life can be different. Some of us are like the older son. We like our Christian faith. We like our holy huddle. We like our Christian friends. We love our church. But we just don't care all that much about those people. There's a message most poignantly in this parable to us when we're the older brother. Will we be like Jesus and take the initiative to be with lost people, to welcome tax collectors and sinners, to have lunch with them or dinner or coffee? Lord, especially with Easter coming up, would you put on our hearts the value of people? And would you give us your heart for people and change our hearts wherever they're like the older brother?